Coming to you from the world-renowned Magnum Building on beautiful Payne Avenue in the heart of Cleveland, Ohio, it's the entrepreneur himself, Dan Hansen, bringing you the Great Lakes Geek Show. Okay, today we're speaking with Tim O'Reilly. Tim is founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media. You know them as publisher of some of the best computer books in the world, but they are also heavily involved in conferences and online technologies. Tim, my first O'Reilly book was probably The Whole Internet User's Guide and Catalog. What was the first book you published?
It's kind of a matter of debate because, like a lot of things, there's no clear beginning or end. Our very first book was actually Unix in a Nutshell, done in a private label edition for one of our documentation consulting clients. But our first book that was available for sale to the public was Learning the Unix Operating System. Actually, it was two we released the same day, Learning the Unix Operating System and Learning the VI Editor. But so it's between those three, you call it.
Okay. Why did you get into publishing?
Well, we were a documentation consulting company, and we didn't like not when we didn't have work, so we found things that were useful to do. We had fallen into Unix. We noticed there wasn't any good documentation, and so we just started writing it in our spare time. And it was also, I recognized pretty early on that open standards meant that everybody shouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. So we started writing these books and licensing them to companies. And then later on, we decided, hey, let's try releasing them to the public, and worked out pretty well.
It sure has. You've come a long way. How would you describe O'Reilly Media today?
Well, we're our central vision is that I actually kind of captured as kind of a mission statement is changing the world by spreading the knowledge of innovators. We believe, and it runs through all of our businesses, whether it's conferences or online publishing with the O'Reilly Network and things like Safari, or our book publishing, is to find people who are doing new and interesting work that's often sort of shared among a small community of early adopters, and then to help it reach a wider audience. And so, you know, with a conference, we bring together those early creators with, you know, an enthusiastic group who wants to learn directly from them, and then we try to capture that in books so that it can be read by, you know, thousands or millions of people. And eventually those technologies become widespread. That's also the root of a lot of our approach to marketing. It's technology activism. You know, we believe that some of these technologies that we discover are important and valuable, and so we do things to spread the word. So, you know, we wrote about the World Wide Web when there are only 200 websites, and we went on a big campaign to say this is this most amazing thing. And, you know, similarly, we realized that not enough attention was being paid to open source software, so we organized a series of meetings to try to raise awareness and craft a story. And so, you know, we organized a meeting in which the term open source was formally adopted by all the project leaders because we thought there was some marketing to be done for these projects that we knew from our book sales were incredibly influential, but that nobody in the regular computer, you know, media was talking about. So this whole idea of changing the world and spreading, you know, new ideas is central to our business, and so we continue to do that. So there's always something that's up front. The big area that I've been working on for the last really since about 2000 is the idea that we're really building an internet operating system. You know, we launched our peer-to-peer and then peer-to-peer and web services conference in 2001. That morphed into what we now call our Emerging Technologies Conference, which happens in March. But it also became the foundation, that idea became the foundation for a conference we do now every fall called Web 2.0. And the fundamental idea of Web 2.0 was that the dot-com boom, or the dot-com bust, rather, was not the end, but actually the beginning of something new and interesting. And it really is this discovery of the internet as platform. What does that mean? What have we learned from the companies that survived the dot-com bust? And what are we learning from the pioneers who are doing new things now? You know, what are the principles, if you like, of success in the internet era? The first generation of any new technology is in the shadow of the preceding generation. So, you know, if you looked in the 80s, people didn't realize yet that these little PC companies like Microsoft were going to become the powerhouses that they are today. In the 90s, it seemed like it was the era of Microsoft, and we didn't realize that it was going to be Google and Yahoo and eBay that would be so powerful today. And I think that's continuing. The web companies are just really starting to come into their own. The web as platform is starting to come into its own. And we're trying to create a gathering place for the movers and shakers of that new era.
Okay, you mentioned the Open Source Summit back in 98 when, you know, you brought the various communities in, Linux, Apache, Perl, Python, Mozilla, all those, and kind of defined open source. What's your definition of open source software?
Well, the definition of open source is formally established on the Open Source Institute's webpage. Despite being a writer, I'm not somebody who's overly fond of definitions. I tend to think as ideas as the core of things, not necessarily their boundary. And a definition tends to be limiting and excluding. And so when I've thought about open source, I've tried to think of core principles. And as a result, I've actually ended up being interested in a lot of things that are not traditionally thought of as significant by the open source community. So while the open source definition focused on the characteristics of open source licenses, and that is in fact the formal definition of open source, it conforms to some set of principles that are outlined in the open source definition. I've seen a set of fellow travelers on the road to the future who are leveraging some of the same principles that are demonstrated by open source. So for example, one of those principles is what I call the architecture of participation. So there is a design in a system such that users pursuing their own individual work create a collective in some way. And so you can kind of see this in the way that that Linux works. In contrast to, Windows, which is sort of organized by a central party, Linux is an aggregate to which anyone can add. You know, there are, there are hundreds of thousands of projects on SourceForge, and those that get users migrate up and eventually get added to a Linux distribution, and it's really, there's no hard edge to Linux, right? It's just, it's basically, if you play by a certain set of rules, you're part of Linux. And in a similar way, the internet has no boundary. It doesn't say, okay, in contrast to, say, early attempts at online content community like CompuServe or AOL, you had to be a member. Well, being on the internet, you download a server, you put up your stuff, nobody links to you, nobody pays any attention to you. You're still part of the internet, but bit by bit, you get promoted from the edges by the attention paid to you by other users. And so I see this architectural similarity between the web, for example, and open source that made me very interested in this direction of understanding, the architecture of participation. How is it that you design systems so that the systems become smarter the more people use them? And so I look at that and I say, well, even though Google is not an open source project, it has that characteristic. It harnesses the link structure of the web and it grows as people create links. I look at Wikipedia and I say, okay, here people are building collective value. I look even at things like eBay or Amazon. eBay is the collective output of all its users. You know, peer-to-peer file sharing systems like Napster originally or its successors. They were designed in such a way that as people pursued their own interests, they still somehow are building a collective work. And so I think that this idea of harnessing collective intelligence through an architecture of participation is an insight that was demonstrated by open source, but it has application well beyond open source. And so I think in a lot of areas that we look at, we can see multiple things. And what our goal at O'Reilly is to tease out what's important. And so, as I said, I thought that the real lesson of open source in many ways was how do people act when they're connected. You know, and hackers are often just you know, an early warning sign of the way the rest of the world is going to act. And successful open source projects are, in fact, projects where some individual or group has figured out how to harness a collective or how to harness a community on this new thing we have of you know, the internet. And you know, my contention was that, which is being borne out, is that other people were going to figure this out, and that it was somewhat independent of this idea of a certain set of licensing characteristics for software. So I guess the point is, I find open source software extremely interesting as a software development methodology. Collaborative development is critical. You know, with Brian Behlendorf of Apache, I helped found a company called CollabNet, which is, you know, devoted to building tools for collaborative development. I think that open source licenses are important and potentially an important protection for user freedoms, but I don't think the story ends there. The story really, you know, to me the real story is in this Web 2.0 direction, which is understanding how the internet is going to transform human behavior. Open source was just an early warning sign of how things are going to work in the world of the internet as it matures.
Okay, you mentioned, of course, Linux and Google. It was one of the conferences, it might have been the GNOMEDEX, where you asked how many people in the room were using Linux and then followed up with how many of you use Google. What was the point you were getting across there?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is, it's related to this Web 2.0 point. A lot of people are still hung up on the framing concepts of the PC era. They think of the software they use as the software that's on their laptop or their desktop or the machine that's on their desk. And in fact, the point of that question, you know, which gets everybody kind of with a rueful smile on their face when they realize that virtually everybody is a Linux user, is twofold. First of all, to an open source audience, it's, hey, think more broadly about what are the applications on Linux. And the applications on Linux are not just OpenOffice and the GIMP and things like that. There are things like Google and Amazon, right? And they're different. They're a different kind of application than took hold in the PC era. They're not desktop applications. And so then you start to ask yourself the question of, is the fundamental premise of many open source activists that, you know, free and open source software will displace proprietary software actually accurate? Because what I see is that free and open source software in the form of Linux are leading to a situation in which value is being driven up the stack to new set of proprietary companies. And I see an analogy between what happened with the IBM PC and what's happening today on the web. And that is that when IBM introduced an open architecture for the PC, they commoditized computer hardware, and Microsoft ended up realizing that software was going to be the new locus of value and creating a set of techniques for lock-in on top of the open platform. And I believe the same thing is happening today. The real impact of Linux in many ways is to commoditize the software market, and that doesn't mean the value goes away. Value migrates up the stack to something new, And, you know, sites like Amazon and Google have just as much potential for lock-in as Microsoft did, but using a new set of rules. And so I think one of the things that I tend to focus on is that, you know, people often, you know, they're always repeating the past, you know, or they're taking the lessons of the last decade and thinking that they will continue going forward. And that's not always the case. And in fact, it's almost never the case. In fact, the rules change over time. The patterns repeat. And that's really the important thing. You have to be able to sort of back up and say, well, what's the real pattern here? So the real pattern that I see, you know, is that, you know, technology as it develops becomes commoditized. And once it becomes commoditized, people find value in new ways. And they try to lock in that value. And that works for a while, and then somebody figures out how to commoditize that, and value moves up the stack again. And that's actually the advance of technology. So unlike a lot of open source activists who kind of have their roots in the sort of free software movement and the thinking that somehow all this stuff, proprietary stuff, is bad, I have this kind of bigger view that this is a natural alternation and a natural progress, a natural happening in the progress of technology. You know, we get proprietary activity. We get people who push that too far, and then the marketplace pushes back. And, you know, so you don't like it when it happens. And I've been as strong a critic of Microsoft when they've erred, and critic of other, you know, the new players. You know, I remember famously, you know, attacked Amazon on their one-click patent, because I think bullying is bullying, even if it is inevitable.
Okay, looking at my large collection of O'Reilly books here, two things really stand out. One is how fast the technology changes. I mean, I've got email, using email effectively here, where I page through and I see a recommendation to use the finger command to find an email address. Or maybe I'm looking at Ruby books now more than Perl or even Python. Is there an expected shelf life for books in this industry?
Well, you know, I would say, first of all, there are some books that last, you know, only a year or two. There are others that, you know, last 10 or 15. A good example, while programming Perl is not as strong a seller as it was 5 years ago. Of course, nothing is as strong a seller as it was 5 years ago after the dot-com collapse took a big bite out of every book publisher's sales. You know, this is a book that was first published in 1991. That's almost 15 years old, still going strong. You know, there's not a publisher out there who wouldn't like to be publishing that book. And yes, so there is a lot of interest in Ruby. There's definitely a growing interest in Python, but I wouldn't count Perl out. And again, I look at you know, another, you know, perennial, Java in a Nutshell, first published in 1995. It's a 10-year-old book. I think, you know, it's certainly the goal of, you know, of an author and a publisher to have a book that's, first of all, worth revising. I should say there's very few books that will last 10 years without revision. You have a few. But you know, most often you'll need to revise them every 3 or 4 years at the longest, and often every year or every year or two.
The other thing that jumps out with your books, of course, is the covers, the strange creatures that we see on the covers. What's the story behind that?
Well, when we first published our very first books, they were all the same brown covers with a little picture of a nut on it. The idea, they were little pamphlets, really, and the idea was, you know, this is everything you need to know about an individual utility in a nutshell. And we realized that people weren't recognizing the fact that there were multiple books because they all had the same cover except for the title. And so we hired a graphic designer to come up with something, and she came up with something that was very sort of expected, geometrical and high-tech. And we rejected the idea, but didn't know what to do with it. We were a small company, and we had an all-hands company meeting at which I shot down this design. And one of our writers went home and happened to talk to her housemate about this. The housemate was a graphic designer at Digital, and she thought, wow, all these genetics program names sound like weird animals. And she created the first crop of covers over the weekend, just on a lark. She created 7 mock-ups of covers, some for books that we didn't even have yet, like Sed and Auk. And they were typically the stranger animals, like the Tarsier on the cover of the Learning the VI Editor, or the, you know, the guy with the big eyes and the fingers, and the slender loris is on the cover of Sed and Auk. So she was really kind of instantiating that idea that UX programs sounded like weird animals. And she sent them in. So it was really also, that was kind of amazing. I think it was a contribution from someone we didn't even know. And so in the context of our later history with open source, I always thought that's a really sweet coincidence, or maybe not a coincidence. And we put them up on the wall, we looked down, and we said, what the hell, let's try it. And it was fabulous, because at first people found them really, a lot of people found them a little odd and off-putting, but they, with familiarity, they became very popular and amazing piece of branding, because of course the animal can become, if you like, an iconic symbol for a program. And since most of our books were about a single program, it really created this idea of the association between an O'Reilly animal and the program itself became sort of a fundamental part of the computer culture.
You've spoken to many user groups over the years and had a lot of involvement with user groups. I know the Annoyances series is really popular now with user groups. In this internet age, are user groups still important? Are they relevant? What's their role, do you see?
Well, user groups are really people getting together about a shared interest. And I think that the focus of user groups changes over time. I remember in the early 80s, there was the Boston Computer Society, and it was all about microcomputers, and eventually it ran out of steam and went away, right? But users came together around other things. And the idea of the user group, the idea of the enthusiast is absolutely core to, I think, the advancement of technology, and certainly core to our business. The people who we cater to, who we learn from, who we engage with, are the people who care enough to, get together and play with this stuff on their own time. In fact, our new magazine, we have a new magazine called Make, which is focused on hardware hacking and the kind of do-it-yourself mentality. And the subtitle that we've chose for the magazine is Technology on Your Own Time. And it's like, you do it because you love it. And that's actually, I think, one of the things that we respond to most in our users, but also in developers, it's just that passion and that love of what they do. And user groups are a reflection of that enthusiasm and excitement. And so, for example, I was reading recently David Hennemeyer Hansen, the creator of Ruby on Rails. In his blog, he talks about what he looks for when hiring, and he says, I wouldn't hire anybody who doesn't develop open source software, because that shows that they're passionate about what they do. Well, you could make the same argument that somebody who participates in user groups is somebody who you want to hire, because they're really passionate about what they do. So you can use it as a guide to a lot of great things.
Yeah, looking at Make, that seems like a perfect fit for a lot of us who've been around for a long time and remember the early days when we were really the geeks there in the room. One last question for you. You got your degree from Harvard in the classics, which is kind of interesting. I was speaking to Chuck Geschke from Adobe the other day, and his degree is in the classics, and then he went on to mathematics. What's the story behind classics, and are there any industry figures out there who might remind you of some of some of their characteristics comparable to some of those figures?
Well, let me start out by what is it about classics. I think, at least for me, reading Latin and Greek, they're very structured languages, and so they kind of train you to think in patterns. And I found, as I was started working on technical documentation, a lot of what was important for me was to be able to recognize the patterns of meaning. What did people need to know? When did they need to know it? And so I think there was some kind of fundamental sort of rigor there. But really, that wasn't it's kind of interesting if you look at all the stuff I was talking about earlier about Web 2.0 and collective intelligence and the like. The original reason I studied classics was because I was convinced that by books like Bruno Snell's The Discovery of the Mind and the like, that something very interesting had happened in ancient Greece, that was a formative period for a certain kind of modern consciousness. And I was interested even then in understanding. It seemed to me that we were entering a seminal period as we globalized. I didn't yet know that it was going to be through the mechanism of the internet, but where we would be sort of really reshaping the way people are. I think we're entering an extremely formative period for human consciousness in some ways. There's a great article on that by Kevin Kelly in Wired not long ago, and it's kind of interesting to see someone else thinking along the same lines. So that was, I had a lot of reasons why sort of classics ended up being relevant. But kind of coming back to, are there any figures who would remind me of classical heroes? Nobody comes immediately to mind. I'm sorry. I wish I could come up with some easy parallels for you, but I'm afraid I can't.
Okay, that was a loaded question. All right, we've been speaking with Tim O'Reilly of O'Reilly Media. For more information, be sure to follow the links to O'Reilly.com. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Great Lakes Geek Show. Come back soon, www.magnuminc.com.